Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Wood Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Here's the Bad News when we come back. You know, we Americans are the most litigious people in the world, and we believe in our lawyers with a kind of religious fervor. We've been taught from early childhood that he who represents himself in court has a fool for a client. But what would you say if a plumber said that? What if your plumber said he who fixes his own pipes has a fool for a client? Or what if a carpenter said that? What if your carpenter said, well, he who fixes his own steps has a fool for a client? Now, doesn't our common sense tell us that a plumber or a carpenter who couldn't fix his own steps or his own pipes is incompetent? You know, my common sense tells me that a lawyer who can't represent himself in court has to be just as incompetent as that plumber or carpenter. Now, listen to James Nielsen. He's a professor, a law school professor at the Hastings Law School. Here's what he had to say about it. He said, quote, it is a fact that a student can graduate from this, the fourth largest law school in the United States, without ever having written a pleading, a contract, a will, a promissory note, or a deed. And he said it's worse than that. Most students graduate from this law school without ever having seen a real honest-to-God pleading, contract, will, promissory note, or a deed, and a student can graduate without having set foot in a courtroom, without ever having spoken to or on behalf of a person in need of advice or counsel, and a student can graduate without once being exposed to the operation of the rules of court. Now, whatever else may be said about this license issued by the state bar, let it be said that for these students and for their clients, that it is a cruel hoax. Now, that's Professor James Nielsen of the Hastings Law School. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Now, while you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. Our courtroom strategy and procedure is also available. That's our school. Now, it's available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can just go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we've been talking about some bad news, bad economic news, and you're getting that every day from Katie Couric and Brian Williams and Charlie Gibson. Every night on the news, they report to you that the price of gas is going up and that the value of your house is going down and that your wages are stagnant and unemployment is growing. I mean, those are the standard. Everybody can hear that. There's nothing behind the scenes there. I thought I would give you a report on what's going on behind the scenes, which you haven't heard yet. Now, last time I reported to you that the Royal Bank of Scotland, that's one of the premier insider banking institutions in the world. Not as big as Goldman Sachs and Lehman Brothers and Bank of America, but it's a big insider bank. They advised their clients on June 9th, I believe the date was, June 9th, 2008. In the next 90 days, you can expect the world's stock markets to collapse. I thought that was pretty newsworthy. I would think that if I was Brian Williams and one of the premier insider banks, you know, came out and said, we expect the stock markets around the world to collapse in 90 days, that, my God, that would be front page headlines. Not a word. Not a word. And that's because sheep aren't supposed to know that. In 1929, Russell Harvey told me that approximately 6 months before the stock market collapsed, that there were rumors. Now, Russell Harvey, I'll tell you where he got his rumors. Russell Harvey was a 32nd degree Mason in 1929. So he was high up in the Masonic order. And he had rumors. He didn't know this firsthand, he said, but he had rumors that the stock market was about to bust. Those were his words, about to bust. Harvey had cashed out of the stock market in 1927 upon earlier rumors that it was about to collapse. He was too early when he cashed out in 1927. Those were his words to me. But he said, better a day early than a day late. Better 2 years too early than 1 day too late. Now, for most of you listening to me now, when it comes time to cashing out at the top, you already missed the top of the real estate market. You already missed the top of the stock market bubble. You've already missed many of these tops. And so now we're in the decline. And we've been in this decline now since August of 2007. That's when the really serious decline began to accentuate itself. So I'm just a reporter telling you that this is where we're at this moment in time. We're at the point where every leading economic indicator, every single one, except the stock market, it's the only one left, every single one has now exceeded its 1929 counterpart. So if you want to take a look at the economic indicators in the 1920s and compare them to today, and then ask yourself, well, now are we on the verge of a depression? The answer is a resounding yes, yes, yes in every category except the stock market, and now the Royal Bank of Scotland tells us that it's about to collapse also, which is inevitable. You know, at some point in time, the dollar is going down in value. The dollar is in a mode of collapse. In fact, the whole Western world is in a mode of collapse, the Western Anglo-Saxon world. And there's a reason for that. There's a cause and effect relationship that goes on in life. You know, when you do certain things, you get certain results. Now, I can remember as a child, I was told that there were five causes for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. It's written by a guy back in 1776, Gibbons. Gibbons' Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So as a young boy, I was instructed that there's a cause and effect relationship that goes on between the greatness of empires and civilizations and their ultimate demise. And so looking back in history, we see that the Egyptians were a great civilization, a great empire, but they're not anymore. So something happened in Egypt to make that transformation. The Roman Empire was a great empire, as were the Greeks and the Babylonians and Assyrians and so on. But as you take a look in history, we find that all the civilizations have collapsed. And one of the five causes of the collapse of each and every one of these civilizations is the debasement of their currency. When you indulge in the debasement of your money, there's an end. There's a result that comes from that. And the result is the collapse of your civilization or your empire. It's taken over by somebody else. Somebody else comes to the forefront, takes over. And that's where the Americans are today. Now, we have the greatest empire that the world has ever known. Most Americans, if you ask them, what do you think of the American empire? They'd look at you with a blank stare. Why, we're not an empire. Why, we're not out here empire building like the British and the Romans and everybody else. I want to point out that we have military bases in 147 countries in the world. Nobody in the world, including the Romans or the British, ever had military forces occupying 147 countries. Hell, we're still in Germany, for crying out loud, and that war's been over for 60 years, hasn't it? I mean, we're still in South Korea, for crying out loud, and we haven't been fighting there since 1953. We've still got military occupation forces in Japan, for crying out loud, and World War II has been over since 1945. And come on, kids, wake up and smell the coffee here. America is a world-girdling, global world power. No two ways about it. And the Russians and Chinese don't even come in a close second. But, here's the big but. America's about ready to collapse economically. And when we collapse economically, then we'll collapse militarily and socially as well. Then we will become one of those past tense has-beens. Now, there's a tragic consequence that comes in here. Nations, when they collapse, they go into national captivity. National captivity. That means there's a foreign invading military occupation force comes in and administers your affairs for you, kind of like the Americans and the British and the French and the Russians did after World War II in Germany, like the Americans did in Japan, you know, after World War II. That does not mean that all the people in Japan died in 1945 and went to heaven. It means that Emperor Hirohito, who was running the country along with the civil authorities like Tojo and the rest, were put out of business, told to go home, sit down, shut up, fold their hands, and be quiet. And General MacArthur would come over here and direct operations, and that's what he did. And from that day to this, the Japanese take their instructions from Washington, D.C. That's just where that bear does it, so that you can understand how that works. Now, the Germans, they're doing the same thing, but to a little lesser degree and to a different beat of a different drummer. And that's what you can expect in Australia, except that when the Australians go under, they're going to be occupied by the Chinese. And those Chinese up there are casting their covetous eyes upon your 3 million square miles down there, and they're going to take it. They're going to take it. They need it more than you do anyway. Hell, they got more people in Shanghai than you have in Australia, and they're going to take over Australia, and they'll give them a place to put those 1.3 billion Chinese. And that's not going to bode well for all of you white Anglo-Saxons there in Australia and New Zealand. So wake up and smell the coffee out there, because that's what's coming in your neck of the woods. Now, that doesn't mean that here in America and in Canada it's going to be any different. And I suspect the Chinese will come over here and take over this operation, too. I suspect. And then I suspect the Russians are going to be right in there somewhere. I don't know exactly where, but in there somewhere. And the reason I say that is because of Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. See, there's another player in the game here. We call him God. Most people don't know this guy. He's a little different breed of cat. But this God gave us some information through Moses. And he said, now, here's what's going to happen to you at the end times. When you people finally turn your back on me and give me the finger and tell me to kiss off, so I'm going to do that. But when I do that, there's going to be some horrible, terrible consequences that come from it. And here's where this is going to end up. That's why I tell people, read them and weep, as they say down at the Blue Room, you know, when you're playing cards, you know, the dealer deals the cards out, and he says, all right, boys, read them and weep, you know, get your bets in. And that's about where we are today. It's time, you know, to sit back and read them and weep, because what we have sowed, we're going to reap, and prospects aren't good. Now, there's a publication here called The Privateer, and last time I left off giving you this report here on The Privateer, and I wanted to give you a little bit more of it. The Privateer is probably the single best educational tool for economics that I've ever seen. I'm an old man. There's an issue of the Privateer that I don't pick up, I don't learn something new. And the Royal Bank of Scotland telling us that we can expect the collapse of the Western stock markets, you know, worldwide stock markets, not just here in the West, but worldwide. And that's because when the American stock market collapses, everybody in the world is tied to us. All of you people in South Korea, foremost, Japan, you're all going down with us. That's going to be a hell of a party. Hell of a party. In fact, I just saw a hell of a number last night. Americans are strapped for money. And you people down in South America, Central America, and Mexico, you rely upon American tourists down there. Hotels all over, south of the Rio Grande, all the way to Tierra del Fuego, are operating at 10% capacity right now, today, as I speak, south of the border. Your tourist industry is running at 10%. And that's because we Americans are tapped out. Hell, we can't pay our credit card debts. We can't make our house payments, for crying out loud. We're being foreclosed on. You think we're going down to Bermuda? You think we're going down to Mazatlan? Huh? Now it's time to wake up, and all of you people around the world are going to feel this economic impact, whether you like it or not. That's where that cookie crumbles. Now, this guy that puts out the privateer, his name is Buckler. Let me give you his name and address here. It's $130 a year. It'll be one of the better $130 bills you ever spent. So if you're thinking about spending your money on gasoline and taking off on vacation, forget the vacation. That's the last thing in the world you need at this juncture of time. But what you do need is a subscription to the privateer, the international forecaster, and the money changer. And if you can't afford all three, well, pick one of the three. If you're going to pick one of the three, I would say pick the privateer, because that's an educational form. It's not the better of the three. Bob Chapman's international forecaster is the better of the three, but Chapman's a professional, and he's not an educator. He's not here trying to teach you what this means. He's a reporter, and boy, he reports hard facts, and he reports them in close succession. But if you want to get your hands-on feel for where we're headed and why we're headed that way, you can't beat this guy, Buckler. He has a neat, nifty way of explaining these economic problems in layman's terms, so that if you are a truck driver and you read the privateer and you can't understand it, you have to be brain dead. Son, if you can't understand the privateer, you are mentally deficient. That's how simple this thing's put together. As dumb as I am, I can understand it. Now, the forecaster, a lot of times, you know, I have to write down words and start looking them up, and I say to my wife, did you understand that? And she says, no, I didn't get that. Now, the forecaster isn't totally incomprehensible. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying there's a lot of places in there where you'll be shaking your head saying, what does that mean? Because it's over a lot of people's heads. Not everybody, but a lot of people. So I'm going to suggest to you, you get a subscription here to the privateer. It's $130 American. It's $180 Australian. So for you Aussies down there, if you're not subscribing to the privateer, get with the program. The guy's address is www.the-, there's a hyphen between the and privateer.com. So it's www.the-privateer.com. And their address is Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads. That's Noosa Heads, Heads, Queensland, Australia. And I suppose this number 4567 is the zip code, be my guess. Guy's name is Bill Buckler, and the privateer, a private market letter for the individual capitalist, published since October of 1984, 25 issues per year. All rights reserved, 2008, copyright owner. I'd avoid mentioning the name George Gordon or the editorial review, because I got a bad letter from this guy some time back. I suggested to him that he send me his newsletter so that I could review it. God, he sent me a scathing letter. He told me everything but a white man. I guess he thought I was trying to steal his material or something like that. I suppose that's what it is. Ordinarily, people send me their material because they want me to advertise and promote it, which I guess here in the United States makes sense, but maybe in other places in the world that doesn't make as much sense. Evidently, it didn't with this fellow Buckler. So, you know, just send in, get a copy of it, keep it on the QT, you know. And I'm not trying to steal this guy's thunder. I'm trying to promote him. I'd like to sell his newsletter. I think everybody out there should have a copy of his newsletter every time it's issued. If you did, I mean, there'd be a hell of a lot more smart people out there who'd be voting a lot different, you know, in the upcoming election than they're going to vote. I'll tell you that right now. Now, he's talking about banks here on page 3. He says, U.S. banks have suffered $391 billion worth of losses and write-downs from mortgage-related securities since the start of 2007. And according to the data compiled by Bloomberg, U.S. banks would lose another $300 billion on real estate loans during the year ahead. Such losses could jeopardize balance sheets because the U.S. banking system only had $1,350 billion of equity capital as of April 1st of this year. All right, now what's that tell you? You got $1,350, you lose six, and that's actually closer to seven. So half of it's gone already. That means that, you know, it's just like you having $1,350 in the bank and you lose $700. Well, you ain't broke yet, but that's not a good trend. Behind the front lines lies contractual commitments which the U.S. banks have already made. So Citigroup Incorporated analysts have said that the banks are concerned that companies may draw on the $6 trillion of loan commitments made before the credit crunch hit, adding to pressure on their balance sheets. And so they've made commitments to General Motors and Ford and others and said, we'll loan you $6 trillion. Now, they've only got $1.3 trillion, but they've promised that they'd loan you six. That's called leverage. Leverage. And, you know, now if these American companies walk in the door and say, well, you made a commitment to us, okay, so give us the money, you know, these people haven't got the money to give. That's what the bottom line of that is. On June 19th, Moody's followed Fitch and Standard & Poor's in downgrading the credit ratings of AmBank, one of the two big mono lines. Those are insurers in the United States. The downgrade was from 3A to AA3, and this could be the last straw. Net risk being more capital destruction in the U.S., 2.6 trillion municipal bond market. Okay. All right, so what he's telling us here is that we got a bond market out here, which is $2.6 trillion, which is on the verge of collapse also. Municipal bonds. That is, you know, cities like Los Angeles, San Diego, New York, they have to go into the marketplace and borrow money for operating capital. And they have to have a bond rating. And then there are bond rating companies, and these bond rating companies issue insurance. Let's try it this way. Let's suppose, you know, New York City wants to sell $100 million worth of bonds, and they come to you and me and they say, hey, buy our bonds. And, you know, you and I sit there and say, well, how do we know you're going to pay us back? So New York City says, well, look, we know we're 3A rated, you know, through Fitch or Standard & Poor's. You know, we got a good credit rating. Well, that's okay, but Orange County went broke. Municipalities have been going broke, you know, for thousands of years. And the fact that you're a city like New York City or you're a state, you know, like California, doesn't mean that you don't go broke or you don't go bankrupt. All the United States of America went bankrupt in 1933. And we went bankrupt in 1783. Just because you're a nation or a city-state or something doesn't mean that your credit's any good or you're going to get paid back if you loan them money. So wake up and smell the coffee here, children. Now, what that means is that New York City says, well, why don't you buy insurance? If you think that our bonds are no good, you know, for dirt cheap policy, you can buy insurance, you know, from Standard & Poor's, and they'll insure our credit. And that's called suretyship, you know, which, you know, you're told in the Bible not to do, but, you know, that's, what the hell does God know about finance anyway? So anyway, the bottom line to that is that these AMBAC and Standard & Poor's and others, their credit ratings have gone down the tubes. The insurance company's credit's no good. So that if New York defaulted on their bonds and you went to collect on your insurance policy, maybe you'd collect, maybe you wouldn't. And then there's the question of, well, what would you collect after you collect it? Let's suppose New York sold you $100,000 worth of bonds, $50,000, $10,000. You know, you can buy municipal bonds, and they're tax-free. And that's the advantage, you know, that you get low interest, but you get security. They're generally pretty safe bonds to buy. And they're tax-free. You don't have to pay taxes on the income that comes from them. So there's reasons why people buy these bonds, but there's also some there's some problems ahead here. As these cities lose their tax base, that is, as the property values go down, then they take in less tax revenue. So how are they going to pay the interest and the principal on the bonds they've already issued? Have you thought about that one, Joe? And that's what their problem is. And so, you know, there's some big questions out here as to whether some of these municipal bonds are going to get paid or not. And the answer is they're not. That's the bottom line. They're not. So if you're holding municipal bonds, you're going to get stung. And if you can unload them, you should. And there's better things to put your money in. And right now, you need to save every single dollar you can. I saw a guy the other day said, you need to pay off your debts and pay down your debt and get as far out of debt as you can get. And I'm sitting here saying, what? Excuse me. Hang on a second here, Charlie. Let's suppose you got $20,000 in your IRA. And let's suppose that you get nervous about that and you want to cash that out. And you got a $150,000 mortgage on your house. And so you're going to take your $20,000 out of your IRA and you're going to pay it against your $150,000 mortgage and pay that down $130. Now you're flat ass broke, Charlie. Now, when the depression hits over here, you got a $130,000 mortgage on your house you can't pay, and so you're going to lose your house. Excuse me, Charlie, but what difference does it make when you lose your house as to whether you owe the bank $150,000 or $130,000? Huh? Looks like to me that $20,000 turned into gold and buried in a hole in the ground would serve you better when you're homeless and living out of your car than having a $20,000 less deficiency judgment to pay. And I just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. In a depression, cash is king. Depression's coming, but not until after hyperinflation. When the hyperinflation runs its course, everybody's going to be flat-ass broke, and there'll be no goods on the shelf, as per what you see in Zimbabwe. And you'll have high unemployment, nothing on the shelf, lots of money in your pocket, and nothing to buy. Then comes the depression. Then comes the really bad news. All right, so if you've got any cash or any access to cash, the logical thing to do is to cash out, turn it to cash, put it into gold, bury it in a hole in the ground, then shut up. Shut up about it. Then when they come and take your house and your car and your flat ass broke, now you're at zero COD and you got $20,000 in a hole in the ground with which to get started again. Seems like to me that that's a better course of action, a better plan. So if you're thinking about paying off your debts, now that was a good piece of advice 7, 8, 10 years ago, which is what I advised all my clients and all my students. I said, hey, you need to be debt-free with a ton of money in cash, all liquid, not in the bank, buried in the hole in the ground. And that was good advice up until now. Now there isn't any point in paying the debt down, because it's too late and you can't get it paid down. And when foreclosure comes, it doesn't make any difference whether you owe $500,000 or $30,000. You lose it all anyway. When somebody comes to foreclose on your house, they take the whole house, whether you have a 60% equity in it or a 10% equity, or you have zero equity in it, they're going to come take the house. Wake up, Charlie, now smell the coffee. Use your head. It doesn't take a lot of brains to figure this out. had a kid here one time, him and his wife are going to come here and go to work, and then he had some debts, and I said, I need to unload these debts over here. And so I suggested to him that he default on some of those debts. And he said, oh, no, I can't do that. That wouldn't be honest. Well, okay. Hey, Charlie, you're going to default on the debt anyway. Why don't you plan? You know, it's kind of like having an airplane, you know, and an engine quits. Pretty soon you're flying along, the second engine quits. Pretty soon you're flying along, the third engine quits. Okay. About the time the third engine quits, this airplane's going to crash. So we should start planning now for the crash. Do we want to have an orderly crash? That is, shall we crash this airplane on flat ground in Kansas, or shall we struggle along until we run into the Rocky Mountains and crash in the mountains? That's, you know, it's your choice. Looks like to me that an orderly bailout down here on the flatlands of Kansas is a better place to land this airplane, as bad as the situation is. Now, crash landing isn't pleasant in any circumstance, but a crash landing at the 12,000-foot level in the Rocky Mountains is less opportune than a crash landing on the plains of Kansas. I just want to point that out to you. So we're all headed for a crash landing. And so, you know, you could kind of orderly figure out a better way to crash this airplane than into the side of a mountain. And that's my suggestion, you know, to use an analogy or a little metaphor there. The privateer could continue with similar items for a long time. But the sum of all of this story is that the entire United States banking and financial system is so threadbare, so fragile, and short of capital that a collapse or crash is one place, or in one place, could knock the underpinnings out from under several other U.S. financial sectors, which would take even more down with them. So a systemic crash at any time is today a distinct reality. So we are headed for a crash. We don't know how bad, and we don't know when. You know, I'm not a prophet. I can't tell you that the stock market is going to crash on September 9th, 2008. I don't know. I'm just a reporter. I said that the Royal Bank of Scotland said they expect it in the next 90 days. Now, that doesn't mean it's coming in 90 days. Maybe 180 days. Maybe 120 days. Maybe 13 days. How do we know? Now, everybody is working hard to stretch it out as long as possible. I mean, we've already stretched it out into the Bush years now for 7 years. You know, they've done everything they could. The crash occurred in March of 2000. That's when the bottom fell out. And then everybody went to work on it, and they patched it up, and they've been flying this airplane, you know, with three engines, you know, for quite a while. Well, now he's lost another engine. Now, the airplane's too heavy to fly on two engines, so now they're throwing out everything they can get out of the airplane. I mean, they're just dumping stuff overboard. Doors are open, they're throwing out the seats, everything they can, keep the thing in the air. And, you know, a few quick calculations shows that even after you throw out all the seats and you get all the passengers, you know, huddled in the back of the airplane, hold on, it's still going to crash. What we don't know is exactly when, exactly where, and, you know, exactly how bad the crash is going to be and how many casualties there's going to be. I mean, we don't know that, but we do know the airplane's going to crash. Everybody's known that for years and years, and so it shouldn't be a great surprise or a great shock to you that the American economy is in trouble or that the world economy is in trouble. That's a given. However, now, what are we going to do about that? And that's why I keep telling my students, you know, Charlie, wake up. You're a truck driver, you know. You got the rent to pay. You got food to put on the table. You know, you got to look out for yourself. Now, the government has you believing that, you know, when things go bad, what you do is you go down and sign up for food stamps. And that's what more and more Americans are doing. They're going down signing up for food stamps. Well, okay, that's a little easier way out than actually going out in the backyard, tearing up the sod on the backyard and planting tomatoes. That's true. But the ultimate end of it is you might as well get used to the idea that if you're going to eat, you're going to grow it in your backyard. And if you ain't got it in your backyard, you're going to have it. Now, that's where reality is coming down to. There's going to be famine now. There's going to be shortages. And you either have it or you don't. Your living standards are going to take a hit. So if you think that you're middle class today, you wake up and face reality because you're going to be middle class tomorrow. That's where that's coming to. Hey, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School. This is Bella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can also be accessed through the website as well. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters, and so on to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to endorse and recommend us. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine or mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or opinions of the advertisers or the sponsors or the management or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the late June issue. This is late June 2008 issue of the Privateer. Now, Privateer is an economic newsletter put out in Queensland, Australia. Queensland, Australia. Can anything good come out of Australia? And the answer is yes, the Privateer newsletter. Put out by William A.M. Buckler, Post Office Box 2004, Noosa Heads, Queensland, 4567, Australia. They got a phone down there. If you want to take their number down, it's 617-5471-1960. That is 617-5471-1960. It says reproduction in any manner without permission is a breach of law and property rights. Well, I agree with you, Mr. Buckler, and so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do everything in my power to help sell this for you. Mr. Buckler needs more subscribers. That's his hot button in life. You know, if you're a businessman, your hot button is selling your product, and this man is selling his newsletter, the Privateer. And I got to tell you that out of all of the newsletters that are out there, and I see a lot of them, this one is number one for education for dumb people like me. This guy has really got a knack for teaching people the ins and outs of the complexities of economics. Now, there's other guys out there, you know, that are good, and I recommend Bob Chapman and Franklin Sanders pretty highly, and that's because both of them are good, really good, at least in my view. You know, I don't agree with everything that everybody says all the time, you know, 100% of the time. I don't think anybody does, but, you know, as a general rule, you know, just going over the material, you know, the number of times that you can point to something that's askew here by any of these three guys, that's Buckler, Sanders, or Chapman. I mean, you got to dig damn hard to find mistakes in here. Now, let's take a look at leverage. Now, leverage, let me tell you what this is, in case you didn't know. Leverage is where you're lending money that you borrowed and don't have. I like that definition. Leverage is money that you've lent to somebody that you didn't have to start with. Now, we call that fractional reserve banking here in the United States. And these big banks out here are lending money they don't have. See, ordinarily, in the normal scheme of things, when we think about banks lending, we think about you and me going down to the bank and depositing money. And the bank then loans our money out to somebody else. Now, that's the way I was taught when I went to school. Okay, and that makes all the sense in the world, you know. Now, what really goes on out here in banking circles, that's true. The bank does take your money and they do lend it up. That's true. But the bank, if they were living off of what they're lending that somebody else deposited in their bank, they'd all starve to death. I don't think they could keep the lights on. The way these guys make money is by leverage. Leverage. Can you say leverage, boys and girls? The way that game is played. They lend out money that they don't have, and they can do that because when you go to the bank and borrow money, you know, just remember the last time you went down and borrowed money? Okay. Did somebody go back to the vault and bring out a pile of gold and give it to you? No. Let me ask you this. Did somebody go back into the vault and bring out a bunch of $100 bills and count them out and hand them to you? No. No. Now, what they did is they wrote up a piece of paper and handed you a checkbook and said, okay, you got $10,000 in your checking account. Go spend it wisely. That's what fractional reserve banking is all about. They just create it right out of thin air. They just hand it to you, and you go out in the marketplace and start buying stuff. And that sends a signal to the guy in the store. I mean, when you go down to the hardware store and you start writing checks and you buy $1,000 worth of stuff, he paid $500 for that stuff that you paid $1,000 for, so he goes out and writes a check for $500 and replaces his inventory, takes the other $500 and goes down to Walmart on a spending spree and buys a bunch of stuff and takes it home. Stimulates the economy. That's the boom part of the cycle. Now, after you've spent your $10,000, now comes the bust part of the cycle. Well, that's the other side coming down. So let's take a look at this leverage here. The financial leverage across the main U.S. investment banks is stupendous. I'm going to underline that word, stupendous. That means big. Goldman's balance sheet, this is Goldman Sachs, their balance sheet brought its gross leverage ratio, that's the amount of assets held compared with the shareholder equity, to 24.3 from 27.9 at the end of the first quarter. All right, now here's what that means. That means that for every dollar that Goldman has in play, it has borrowed another $24.30 simply to increase its bets. So I'm going to underline increase its bets. That's not investing, that's gambling. So for every dollar that Goldman has out here in the way of assets, they got $24.30 lent out. Well, you know, if something goes haywire over here and these people don't pay that 24 bucks, hell, if they just don't pay $1 out of that 24, Goldman's broke. Do you understand that? 24 to 1 leverage ratio. Hey, that ain't good, kids. That ain't good at all. And that's just one. Hell, they're all like that. In fact, I did a research analysis one time on the banking system. This was many years ago, 20 years ago. And I looked at the 5% reserve requirement that they got. Let me tell you what 5% means. That means that for every dollar that you've got over here, you can get 20 more at 5%. So let's suppose a bank's got 100,000 bucks. So they take 100,000 bucks and they take 5% of that and send it off to the Fed and they lend out 95. That 95 is now a new asset, and so they take 5% of the 95, send that to the Fed, and then lend out the balance, and then they take 5% of that, and so on down the line. They can keep lending that out. They can keep pyramiding that leverage out there so that they can take that $100,000, and they can lend out, I forget, $20 million, I think it is, $20 million, I believe. How much money have they really got? $100,000 less than 5% that they kept sending into the Fed to maintain their reserve requirement. Now, that's the way that game is played. Talk about a house of cards. Now, this house of cards has been going on since 1933. That's when they started. It was with the New Deal. Said, hey, let's get off gold. Let's go out here and print money. Let's give the banks all this latitude. Now, Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, he just came up to Congress the other day, and he says, hey, I want you to give the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve extraordinary powers, emergency crisis powers. Well, they haven't done it yet, but they're going to. You can rest assured. When the stock market collapses, they will give the Treasury and the Federal Reserve whatever powers they want. To show you how that game was played, down in Brazil, they went through a hyperinflation down there. Their hyperinflation set in from, went up from high, I don't know, 60% to 5,000% in 3 days. I mean, they had hyperinflation to start with, and it went up from about 60 to 5,000% in 72 hours. About the same amount of time as you've got food in your emergency pack, 7% of you out there. So when this thing hits, kids, it happens fast. It can happen slow, but it can happen real fast. So if you think you're going to have any warning when this train comes down track, you can forget that. It's just going to hit you like a bolt out of the blue. You won't know what happened to you. It'll just knock your ass over tea kettle, and you'll sit there and shake your head and say, what happened? You and me and everybody else. So now, I took a look at this some years ago, and I said, well, gee, maybe I ought to get something scoped out here for myself so that I can feed, clothe, and house myself. So I can do that. So the good news is this. Let's take 100 of us. You got George Gordon, this little Georgie over here, and you, and 98 other people, and we're all standing in line waiting for our handout from the government, from FEMA. Okay? Now, little Georgie Gordon gets impatient, and I'm going to get out of the line and leave you and 99 other people there standing in line waiting for your handout. So here's what I'm doing for all of you. I'm taking myself out of the loop. Whatever it was that I was going to take and share with my family at your expense, I'm now going to leave it in the pot for you, Bob, Sally. And that's good for all of you people out there, because now you don't have to share it 100 ways, you only have to share it 99 ways. You can stand in line and share it with 99 other people. And I think that that's a step in the right direction. And so I've been telling my students, take yourself out of the line, go prepare for yourself so that you can leave more for the other guy. Leave more for the other guys. And in the meantime, you'll live better. Because if you've got your own tomatoes and your own peppers in the backyard, you know, and you're not standing in line sharing the peppers and tomatoes that you think you're going to get out of Hermosillo, Mexico, which I kind of doubt that you're going to get. But, you know, you can have high hopes, you know, if you desire to. Now, the U.S. federal fiscal position is this. The banks, looking down the line of the main U.S. investment banks, one finds the following leverages. Lehman's leverage ratio, compared with its own equity, fell from 25 to 32 at the end of the first quarter. 32 to 1 leverage. That compares with 34 at Bear Stearns, and remember, they just went bankrupt. Their leverage was 34. Lehman is 32 at the end of the first quarter. So, no, they're not quite as leveraged out as Bear was. They got two more to go. 33 at Morgan Stanley, 24 at Goldman Sachs. The biggest U.S. securities firm by market value based on data compiled by Bloomberg. And what this also shows is that were they all to take losses in the market to the same tune of 4% or so, none of them would have any capital left at all. So if they lose 4%, oh my God, what does that tell you? You know, that's like saying, I owe $230,000 on my house. If I have a 4% cut in my salary, I will not be able to make my payment. Hey, I can't figure it that close, boys and girls. I couldn't predict, you know, from 1 year to the next whether I'm going to have 4% increase or 4% decrease in my total net income. And I don't know of anybody else that can predict it that close either. And if these companies lose 4%, it's all over. What do you think, kids? Hell, they've already lost that 4%. They're already upside down. If these companies went to the Small Business Administration, the SBA, and filled out the SBA form to get a loan, they couldn't qualify. I'm telling you, Bank of America could not qualify for an SBA loan. You got that? Goldman Sachs, all these big investment banks, all these big name banks, Citigroup and all this, you know, gold card crap that you hear on TV all the time. If those guys walked in the door at the SBA to get a loan, they couldn't qualify. They haven't got enough capital. They haven't got enough assets. And these are the people that are running your country, running your international finance, huh? And these are the people you're going to vote for. These are the people that control your political process. So just in case you didn't know, the game's over. They just haven't called it yet. I mean, it's raining. The game is over. And the referee is just out there waiting to call the game. Now, the much vaunted U.S. tax rebates that have gone out to millions of Americans. Remember that that crazy thing the president out here said, well, we got to stimulate the economy. This thing is upside down by $49 trillion and they sent out $150 billion. You know, it's like being upside down $49 million and somebody sends you $150 and says, spend it wisely. Or something like that. I don't know if that's exactly the ratio, but I mean, it's a pittance, you know, by comparison. But it made all you people feel real good, didn't it? You got your $600 to spend it wisely. It is now very clear how they were funded. The U.S. Treasury borrowed the money. So, you know, the government didn't send you $600 because they're rich Uncle Lyle, you know, from Fort Bragg. It was that they just went out and sent you borrowed money. They just sent you the check. Go out and spend it. The federal government ran a monthly budget deficit of $166 billion in May. That's not $166 billion for the year. That's $166 billion for the month of May. Hell, we're talking Weimar Republic, you know. This is just insane numbers. The Treasury Department has said this was a record for the month of May. For the first 8 months of fiscal 2008, the budget deficit totaled $319 billion, 115% larger than the $148 billion budget deficit in the same period during 2007. So what they did was they just wrote out those checks, sent you $600, and said, here, have a good day. And vote, oh, by the way, vote for Barack Obama. The U.S. global trade deficit. The U.S. export sales totaled $155 billion in April. That was up 3.3%. But this increase was swamped by a 4.5% increase in imports. So you exported 3.3% more, but you imported 4.5% more. So you just got a bigger deficit than you had last year at the same time. Also, I set a record, $216 billion. Now, the U.S. trade deficit through the first 4 months of this year is running at an amount of about $700 billion a year, up slightly from last year's deficit of $700.3 billion. U.S. imports now exceed U.S. industrial production. God, that ought to make you stutter. Let me underline that. Here's what that means. The U.S. imports, that is the amount of stuff that you're buying from China, Japan, South Korea, and so on, now exceeds what you people produce. God, kids, if that doesn't scare the living hell out of you, nothing will. I've never heard numbers like that before. That's death warmed over. If that's a kick in the, you know what, that isn't going to fly. Or as George Bush would say, this will not stand. This cannot stand. I want to repeat, your U.S. imports now exceed U.S. industrial production. That bluntly means that the U.S. cannot export its way out of trouble. And you people can't even pay your damn bills. And, you know, it used to be a little hope for you, you know. We used to say, well, you know, we'll just wake up in the morning and put in a couple extra hours every day and we'll pay this off. No, you won't. No, you won't. So I told you people yesterday up in Canada, said, you know, you're nice guys up there in Canada. God love you like brothers, you know. We ought to. I mean, we're living off of you. But, I mean, if you think that us Yankees down here are ever going to pay you people up there in Canada for your oil, you get your head up the wrong end here. So the sooner you shut off all of your exports to the United States, the better off you're going to be. The sooner you Chinese out there shut off all of your exports to the United States, the more money you're going to have in your own pocket and the more goods you're going to have in your own pocket. Because you send it over to us. We're going to use it and consume it. Go ahead, Chinaman. Send your tennis shoes over here. We'll take them. We'll send you a 3x5 card and say, well, you know, someday if we ever get the money, we'll pay you for the tennis shoes. Good luck. Because you're not going to get paid. You're sitting over there on $1 trillion worth of U.S. dollars, and you ain't going to get paid. That's the bottom line. Now, that doesn't mean the Chinese are going to take that land down. You know, that's the stuff of war. You know, you go out here and screw somebody over for $1 trillion, you know, and they can get real nasty. And I think those Chinese over there are going to get real nasty with us. Now, the Canadians up there, you know, they'll get real surly, and they'll get nasty, too. I mean, they'll get uppity. But they aren't going to send an invasion army down here and conquer us. But watch out for those Chinese now, because those guys over there are kind of mean. And Deuteronomy 28 says that they're going to get real, real angry, and that they're going to kill your wives and your little children in front of your eyeballs before they kill you. Now, that's the way your God said he's going to bring that deal down, so I thought I'd pass that on to you. The U.S. consumer is flat broke. The torn apart balance sheets and high debt ratios of the U.S. household sector show that even near record low U.S. interest rates, cannot revive the U.S. consumer sector, where debts are now up almost 140% of disposable income. Did you get that one? Hey, Charlie, you owe 140% more than you're making. That don't sound good. Now, the U.S. banks are near insolvent, and the U.S. Treasury is broken. So are most Americans. I did a series here the other day. America, the richest nation in the world. I mean, hell, what the hell are you people talking about? We're flat-ass broke, can't pay our bills. Yeah, we're the richest nation in the world. Have we got our heads up the wrong end over here? I want to just tell the rest of you people out there in the world, you know, the sooner you shut us off, the better. You know, we're like a bunch of drug addicts and alcoholics over here. We're just drinking and partying and having a great time at your expense. And it's time for us to all wake up and realize that we Americans are not going to pay our debts. And for all of you people that are lending to us, you're not going to get paid back what we're borrowing. Okay? So you need to be in a secured position. And boys and girls, here's some more bad news. There's a lot of guys out there that are sitting in secured positions. They're holding the mortgage on your house over in Beijing, China. And they're going to come over here and take possession of your house there in Boston, Massachusetts. Now, that's the bad news. You're going to have a Chinese landlord. You're going to have a Japanese, South Korean, or a Formosan landlord over here in those cars and all these big corporations, you know, all this money. When this thing turns turtle, there's going to be a gigantic shift in the ownership of the real property in the United States, and it's not going to be held by Americans. Now, that's the bad news. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a final reminder here on this show that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in more than 112 countries daily, worldwide, over the Internet and radio. Now, for more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We'll have to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing. Of course, I'll tell them thanks for listening, everybody. Good night, friends.